This week, the people of Israel in Moab conclude the covenant. When we open the book of Deuteronomy, we discuss the fact that it follows the form of an ancient suzerainty treaty between God and his people. In that form, there is a recounting of a people's history, the record of the rules they must follow in keeping the treaty, blessings and curses to fall on those who keep or fail to keep the covenant, instructions on depositing and keeping copies of the treaty, and then the invocation of witnesses to ratify the covenant. Having come through most of those parts, we're now in the final section. We know where Israel came from, we know what they're supposed to do in their interaction with God, we know that God has a copy of the covenant in the tabernacle and that the people are to have one on top of Mount Ebal. We know that the people have called curses on themselves if they fail to keep the covenant, and now Moses is going to give us the closing remarks. And herein, we'll have a quick historical review, identification of the people making the covenant, and some brief warnings to them that they ought to keep the covenant, both them and their descendants forever. So then, your passage, if you have not yet read it, is Deuteronomy 29, and I recommend that you pause and read it now. There is a saying, not quite accurate, but demonstrative of the point, that God delivered the words of the Bible, and the devil added the chapter and verse numbers. Well, obviously that's not true. Devout Christian scholars added the verse and chapter divisions to make study easier. But it is true that these verse and chapter designations were not part of the original text, and sometimes the way the chapters and verses are divided can lead us to understand the scriptures a little differently. Thinking that this goes with that, or that that goes with this, when it ought to be the other way around. So when I read the first verse of Deuteronomy 29, I wonder whether it might more aptly be contemplated as the last verse of chapter 28. 29:1 reads, "These are the words of the covenant that the Lord commanded Moses to make with the people of Israel in the land of Moab, besides the covenant that he had made with them at Horeb." But then we go on through the chapter and don't really read any covenant so much as we read a concluding summary of the covenant. Now, maybe I'm splitting hairs and picking nits here, but my guess is that this verse is not an introduction to this chapter, which comes after it, but is a conclusion to everything that came before it. So this isn't the introduction to the conclusion so much as the conclusion of the introduction. All the commands given in Deuteronomy and all the curses and all the blessings, these are the words of the covenant that the Lord commanded Moses to make with the people of Israel in the land of Moab. The beginning of the law, Exodus, Leviticus, and to a lesser extent Numbers, was the covenant made at Horeb. The rest was appended in the wilderness wanderings and here in Moab, with Deuteronomy acting as something of a recap and addendum. The covenant had first been made with their fathers at Mount Horeb, that is, Sinai. And now that the revelation has been completed in the wilderness wanderings, Moses has delivered it to the people, along with instructions to renew it upon crossing the Jordan, a second copy of the law. In this chapter, then, Moses delivers the conclusory remarks after the covenant has been given. In verses 2 through 9, we have a brief overview of Israel's history, and I won't spend long here because we've been over it and over it and over it again. The sons of Israel were slaves in Egypt. God brought them out with signs and wonders and trials. They wandered the wilderness for 40 years. They defeated Sihon and Og in battle to claim the land east of the Jordan for the 2.5 tribes. Among those repeated themes, we have a few unique and interesting points. First, God emphasizes the way that he supported them in the wilderness. Despite having diminished resources in the wilderness and despite having expended considerable energy on moving around, neither Israel's clothes nor sandals had worn out. Now, I don't take that to mean that everyone was wearing the same clothes that he wore when he walked out of Egypt. Half of these people were children at that point. It seems unlikely to me that they grew up and inherited their father's decades-old shoes. Rather, the intent, I believe, is that while they were in the wilderness, they didn't do without food and clothing. They were able to use the things they had to make what they needed. So my supposition is that their shoes didn't wear out in the sense that there was always enough to repair or replace them, so that they never had to wear worn-out shoes or clothes and so forth. Verse 6 says of the people that, "You have not eaten bread, and you have not drunk wine or strong drink, that you may know that I am the Lord your God." And that struck me as a little odd at first. It seems that bread and wine might be symbols of God's provision, symbols of feasting and excess. How is it that not having these symbols of God's provision demonstrates to them that he is the Lord their God? It seems more like they're being deprived, such that they should perhaps believe that God is not supporting them. Well, these things don't represent feasting in excess, at least not in this context. Here, bread would have been a step down from the manna, which the people had eaten in the wilderness. Manna is miraculous, heavenly bread, and so it much more demonstrates God's divine provision. Wine, likewise, would be a step down from the miraculous provision of water in the wilderness, both that which comes from the rock and that which was made sweet despite having been bitter. And of course, I note that an excess of wine is itself a serious problem that keeps a person from knowing God. But the point is this. In the wilderness, you've experienced sustenance by divine intervention, better than even an abundance of the good stuff. And yet, despite all these great wonders, we read in verse 4 that the people still did not have eyes to see, or ears to hear, or a heart to understand. And that, I must say, is a little unsettling, because I often think that, in considering the generations of the Bible, this is probably the best one. The adults who walked out of Egypt had been downright rebellious, but now they've all died off, except for Moses, Joshua, and Caleb. The generation to which Moses now speaks is their children. They've lived practically their entire lives with God's visible manifestation in the cloud right in front of them. And while they're not perfect, we will see great faithfulness in them in the book of Joshua. Over and over again in that book, we read that they were faithful to observe what Moses had commanded them, and that they, unlike their fathers, undertook the dangerous task of conquering the promised land. It appears to me that if ever there was a generation that faithfully observed God's laws, this was the one. Of course, as I have noted elsewhere, there is more to seeing, hearing, and comprehending than simple obedience to God's laws. This reference to seeing and hearing but not comprehending becomes a repeated theme throughout the Bible, often aimed at the nation of Israel. Isaiah said it several times in his book at chapters 6, 44, and 52. In reading Isaiah's work, we note that there is one reference at 52:14 in which the kings of the world, who formerly had not heard, see the Messiah and are finally said to see and hear and understand. Jesus in Matthew chapter 13 and other places cited this principle from Isaiah, calling the Jews of his day a people who did not see and hear and understand. And Paul also in Acts 28 cites this passage to say that the Jews, though they had eyes and ears, could not see and hear and understand. But we read it again in Romans 15, where Paul defends his ministry to the Gentiles, saying that a people who had not heard now hear and do understand. So we have this interesting little paradox throughout the Bible. The people who were Israelite by birth had the eyes to see the works of God and heard told of them in their ears and had them in their history. But they, as a people, regardless of the actions of one generation, continued year after year without having a full comprehension of the greatness that would come in the Messiah, Jesus. And when that greatness ultimately came, we know what happened. Jesus was rejected by the Jews, and his message of salvation was brought instead to the Gentiles, a people who had not previously heard, but who received it with great joy when they did. So my expectation is that this verse was not written so much to speak to the character of this one relatively righteous generation, so much as it was written to set the stage for a broader principle which we will see as we move on out of the Torah. Being born of God's people doesn't immediately make you one of God's people. There are no grandchildren in the kingdom of heaven. And while the law was given to the people of Israel, there is something more that is needed to comprehend a true relationship with God. And that something more comes in accepting Jesus as the Messiah and being filled with the Holy Spirit. We've been heavily emphasizing the law in our studies as of late, but we must remember that the law and its beneficial impact in this life aren't the ultimate solution to the question of sin which the Bible sets out to answer. The law is a partial solution. It is a temporary solution. It will help the problem, but in the end, the law is not a cure for sin. It is a bandage that stops the bleeding until we get to the heavenly surgeon. So regardless of how good these people may have been, their spiritual renewal was still lacking. And at the end of this paragraph, there is a conclusion. Therefore, keep the words of this covenant and do them, that you may prosper in all that you do. And indeed, it is good for a people to do so. Moving on to verses 10 through 15, we have a review of the people with whom God is making his covenant. And here we see clearly that a relationship with God has not ever been only for those who were naturally born of Israel. That, of course, is a topic which we have discussed previously. For more information on various groups of people and the proximity of their relationship to God and his people under the Old Covenant, I recommend that you listen to our message, Foreigners, Strangers, Sojourners, Immigrants, Aliens, in which we actually cited this passage. The point here, though, is that God's covenant was not only for those born into the natural family, but for all of the people who came with them. It was for the men, the women, the children, the leaders, the followers, the native-born, the sojourner, the free man, and the slave. Everyone could experience God's blessings, everyone could experience God's curses, and everyone was to commit himself to obedience to God's laws. And so, having quickly reviewed the history and parties to the agreement, we have a final adjuration to keep the covenant, not individually, but corporately, and with purity. And the fundamental essence of the covenant is espoused in verses 16 through 17. The people should not serve idols or the false gods whom those idols represent. God here evokes the memories of what the people saw in Egypt and in the nations through which Israel passed in the wilderness. They had seen the foreign gods, and these foreign gods were detestable, and I am sure that they were most detestable in the ways in which their peoples served them. The essence of the covenant with God is to be devoted to him and him alone, and from the devotion due to God flows the desire to obey his commands and to walk in his ways. Comparing this lifestyle, one of wisdom, righteousness, justice, and freedom, to the lifestyle of ignorance, wickedness, lawlessness, and slavery, can only provoke a disdain for the imagined gods, truly godlessness, which it inspires. And so, the people were to avoid serving the gods of the nations around them, despite the fact that these peoples would be forever surrounding them and at their edges to infiltrate or corrupt them. For this reason, God points out that there is a need for the people to be cautious, lest there should be any impurity, or poison, as the passage puts it, among their people. This poison would come in the form of any person who would turn away from serving Jehovah with his whole heart. The poisoned person would turn either to another god, or simply to another way than God's way, and in doing so, he would become a drag on everyone else, as we have discussed many times before. Despite this, he would think secretly to himself that he would be safe. And often, that's how the temptation to sin works. A person knows the right thing to do, but decides to do something else because he either thinks that there is no harm in it for himself or anyone else, or because he thinks that he is doing that which is in his own best interest, despite the harm which it causes to others. Sin always looks good. If it didn't, people wouldn't choose to do it. And this is why we must all be cautious to ground ourselves in the Word of God, so that we do not make our own decisions, but allow the Word of God to make the decisions for us. When corrupted people seep into the society, they influence everyone, and before long, the whole society is corrupt. And while the passage tells us that the harshest penalties will ultimately come on the one who is the agent of corruption, it also tells us that punishment will come on the entire people, on the moist and the dry alike, for allowing this deadly poison to take root. And do you know what I find interesting here? God's people, permitting corruption, were scheduled for destruction, while the peoples around them evidently were not. We read that the foreigners, the nations from far away, would see all the horrors with which Israel had been cursed, with sickness and fire and barren lands, and would be shocked by them, and they would ask, why? Why did this come on these people? And the answer would be that they had abandoned the one true God to serve the foreign gods of the nations. And that might seem a little ironic. The foreign nations serve false gods, and this calamity didn't fall on them. They're shocked by the calamity. Rather, it fell on the people of Israel, because they served these same false gods. Why does it fall on them? And the answer is simple. We hear it in the words of Jesus recorded in Luke 12:48. Everyone to whom much was given, of him much will be required, and from him to whom they entrusted much, they will demand more. God's people have been given much, and they owe much. These foreign peoples hadn't seen the evidences of God. They hadn't been given the laws of God that they might follow them. They hadn't been warned of the curses of God which would overcome them if they failed to follow. And perhaps most of all, they hadn't sworn to follow anything. They didn't sign up for this. They didn't get the special benefits of having signed up. So the foreign peoples served false gods, and they knew nothing of the true God. But if anything, they would receive greater grace in the day of judgment because their wickedness was done in ignorance. They didn't know they were doing wrong, and they didn't know the consequences. Not only that, but they didn't know all the blessings that they had missed by missing a connection with the one great and glorious God of the universe. In contrast, God's people knew better. They had been taught better. They had sworn to obey, and under those circumstances, the failure to obey was much more grievous. And I will warn modern believers that this still applies to any among us who might become apostate. Hebrews 10:28-29 puts it well. Anyone who has set aside the law of Moses dies without mercy on the evidence of two or three witnesses. How much worse punishment do you think will be deserved by the one who has trampled underfoot the Son of God and has profaned the blood of the covenant by which he was sacrificed and has outraged the Spirit of grace? As a Christian, you have been given the greatest blessings and the most spiritual support available. You did not only have ears which did not hear and eyes which did not see, but you had ears to hear and eyes to see and a heart to understand. If you then abandon God from your position and turn away from serving him, if you become unrepentantly apostate from the faith, then you should expect to receive a worse punishment than any unbeliever from birth ever did. And finally, in verse 29, we have an encouragement that the people are to obey these rules forever. In this verse, we find it said in an interesting way, that the secret things belong to God, but the revealed things belong to his people. The Torah never claims to be the completion of divine revelation, nor the end of all knowledge. There are truths in the world, truths which man can discover, whether by divine revelation or scientific inquiry, and truths which man cannot ever know. The Torah is not the whole sum of all knowledge. God knows more than we know, and he always will. Some secrets will stay with him. God revealed much more, though, after the Torah was given, such that Christians, knowing the Son, have a fuller understanding of God than the Israelites ever did. And the explorations and scientific inquiries of man have discovered many things which the Torah never contemplates. Indeed, the Torah is a good foundation, but it is only a fraction of all that there is to know. And the people of God could not be accountable for knowing all these things. But as for the things which had been revealed and which they did know, they owned them, and they were responsible for them, and they were responsible to pass them on to their children forever. And indeed, the revealed things have been handed down generation after generation, and to the whole world, such that we now know them, and that they will endure with mankind forever. Indeed, if they owned this covenant, we own something of much greater responsibility. We have eyes to see, we have great knowledge, and we have great responsibility. But back to the people of Israel, unfortunately, spoiler alert, the children of Israel won't continuously keep these laws forever. All the curses which we discussed last week and which are mentioned here ultimately did come on the people of Israel after hundreds of years of generation after generation which did not obey the laws or maintain any kind of spiritual purity. And so with that, we conclude the covenant. We've skipped only one section of laws, that being the commands about how the promised land was to be divided up among the people. And we skipped it because we're planning to talk about it in conjunction with the book of Joshua, where the land was actually divided up. But other than that, that's it. We're through the law of Moses. And so from here, we're going to be moving on to the concluding narratives. Next week, we'll plan to discuss Joshua as Moses' successor. Thereafter, we'll consider Moses' song and final blessings, and finally, we'll wrap up the Torah with Moses' death. I hope that you're looking forward to continuing our study as much as I am, and that you'll be listening again next week. For those of you who are listening to this message away from your computer and are looking for more like it, you can find us at eastjordan.church.